From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. The last hour of the program tonight, one of Osama bin Laden's wives and sons has written a book, Growing Up Bin Laden. Osama bin Laden wanted his son to become a suicide bomber. He didn't want anything to do with it. We're going to be talking with the author of the book, the son and the wife. They do not speak English. Here's what's happening. The largest earthquake to hit Haiti in more than 200 years rocked the Caribbean nation Tuesday, collapsing a hospital where people screamed for help and heavily damaged other buildings. U.S. officials reported bodies lying in the streets, and an aid official described the total disaster and chaos, reporting that thousands of people may be dead. Communications were widely disrupted, making it impossible to get a full picture of damage as powerful aftershocks shook a desperately poor country where many buildings are flimsy, electricity out in many regions of that country. Jim Berkland, geologist, just talked with him yesterday about the earthquake in Northern California. Jim, this is huge for Haiti. Tell me what you've heard.
Well, this takes it all out of the realm of academic studies of earthquakes. This is, I think, one of the greatest tragedies to hit the Western Hemisphere. We do know that, the best guess is now thousands killed in this country with, 9 million people and all crowded in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And the houses are so clustered together and poorly constructed that there's no streets and there's no way to get to many of them. And this is going to take weeks and months to bring in enough aid, and I don't know how they're going to.
It's a disaster. Jim, is Haiti prone to earthquakes?
Oh, yes.
It is. Yeah. Okay.
It's not far from the, it's part of the Antilles, and they have the greatest trench, the depth of the trench in the Atlantic Ocean is there off Puerto Rico. And it's just off, you know, it's a little further to the south and the east.
What are the possibilities of this 7-point earthquake triggering any earthquakes along the New Madrid Fault?
Oh, very, very low.
Okay.
That possibility, but it has triggered over 300 earthquakes, and you look at the list, and many of them are more than 5 magnitude, and each of them can be quite disastrous for this poor little city.
This death count that we've talked about will go much higher, where we're seeing thousands of dead right
thousands,
now.
Thousands, yes.
Jim's website will be in our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Thank you, Jim. A story we've been talking about for a couple days, a mystery object from space is about ready to whiz by Earth on Wednesday. It won't hit our planet, but scientists are stumped by what exactly it is. Astronomers say it may be space junk, or it could be a tiny asteroid, too small to cause damage, even if it hit. It's 33 to 50 feet wide at most. NASA says that on Wednesday at 7:47 a.m. Eastern Time, it will streak by Earth, missing Earth by 80,000 miles. In the western United States, it may be bright enough to be seen with a good amateur telescope. You know, several weeks ago, I talked about the possibility that we could get hit with an asteroid. We were talking with Ed Dames about that. Reports of airplanes hitting birds and other wildlife surged last year, including serious accidents such as birds crashing through cockpits and crippling engines in flight. More than a dozen states across two migration routes from Minnesota to Texas have seen the highest increases. The government's tally for all bird strikes last year could reach or even exceed 10,000 for the first time, which would represent about 27 strikes every day. There were at least 57 cases in the first 7 months of 2009 that caused serious damage, and 3 in which planes and a corporate helicopter were simply destroyed by birds. At least 8 people have died, 6 more hurt because of this. In Mesquite, Texas, the parents of a 4-year-old boy disciplined for having long hair have rejected a compromise from a Texas school board that agreed to adjust its grooming policy. The impasse means that the pre-kindergartner, Taylor Pugh, will remain in school on suspension, sitting alone with a teacher's aide in a library. He has been sequestered from classmates at the Floyd Elementary School there in a Dallas suburb since last November, After a closed-door meeting Monday, the Mesquite School Board decided the boy could wear his hair in tight braids, but keep it no longer than his ears. But his parents say the adjustment isn't enough for Taylor, who wears his hair long, covering his earlobes and shirt collar. James Cameron's completely immersive spectacle Avatar may have been a little too real for some fans who say they have experienced depression and suicidal thoughts after seeing the film because they long to enjoy the beauty of the alien world Pandora. On the fan forum site Avatar Forums, a topic thread entitled Ways to Cope with the Depression of the Dream of Pandora Being Intangible has received more than 1,000 posts from people experiencing depression and fans trying to help them cope. The topic became so popular last month that the forum administrator had to create a second thread just so people could continue to post their confused feelings about the movie. Howard Bloom, who just is an expert in the mind, is on with us now. Howard, why would people feel depressed and suicidal just after watching a movie?
Well, you put your finger on it a few seconds ago when you talked about Pandora, the planet that doesn't exist, and the Na'vi, the people living on Pandora, the people who don't exist. This film, and when you put your finger on an immersive experience, apparently, because I've been reading the threads here, just as you have, apparently the paradise that James Cameron has produced through the miracle of film, if you want to call it that, is so persuasive, so powerful, that for kids anywhere from the age of 14 to about 30, when you feel displaced in life, when you're in between leaving your family and you haven't found a new family yet, and you're not certain of your friends, you're without moorings, well, all of a sudden there's this wonderful paradise, and it satisfies all of your needs, and it satisfies your needs for idealism. The people live in ways that are beyond belief. I mean, they are committed, they are honest, they are caring. They are in touch with each other and in touch with their own feelings. They are absolutely the ideal. And if you, again, are like, you know, a clam sits very close to the ground. It's stuck there. It's in a shell. It doesn't have any way of moving. But it gives birth to little things called veligers, baby clams. And baby clams have, guess what? They don't have a shell. They have a tail. Mm-hmm. They're built for propulsion. Well, when you are built for propulsion, you have no moorings. That's when you're out in life, out to seek your fortune, is what it used to be called in fairy tales. And that's the way we are from 14 to 30, roughly.
Well, what this is telling you, Howard, about the human mind, for people to get so upset because they're not there.
Well, two things. It tells you that I talk about in my recent work, I talk about messianic capitalism. And one of the goals of messianic capitalism is to be able to deliver things to people before they even know they need it. Well, James Cameron has done that in a spooky and astonishing fashion. But he's hit kids who really do need a settling place and a mooring place and probably won't get it for another 10 years. How long did it take you, George? I know it took me a long time before I was thoroughly moored into the Edel.
I started early. I was fortunate.
Well, you were lucky, but I know it took me a long time, and it takes a lot of other people a long time. And when you suddenly see that there is a place where you could have everything that you long for and everything that you are missing in life, being torn away from it is heartrending. And there's another little thing. Anousheh Ansari, and you know the name of the Ansari X Prize?
Yeah.
Okay. Anousheh Ansari and her brother are the ones who provided the money for the X Prize. And Anousheh Ansari, who made her money with a technology company, had enough money to be able to buy one of those tickets to outer space, one of those tickets to the space station that the Russians have been selling for $20 million to $25 million apiece. Anousheh spent 4 or 5 days up in space, and when she was about to come back, she suddenly realized that everything there had been so peaceful, it had been so remarkably good, it had been so remarkably free of all of the dirt and the problems and the dishonesties here on the face of the Earth, that she was hit really big with a depression when she was on her way back. And what we found out when we were talking about this, because, you know, I'm in the space community with Buzz Aldrin and Edgar Mitchell and people like that,
sure,
who spent a lot of time up there, is that everybody, almost everybody who has been to space has had that depression on coming back. Because coming back to streets with newspapers and crime and
traffic jams.
Yeah, and earthquakes and Haiti. Coming back to all of that just seems horrible. Absolutely horrible after you've been immersed in paradise.
Well, I find this to be an amazing story. Howard, thank you. His latest work, The Genius of the Beast. is your cholesterol too high? Now, this may not be due to just your eating habits. After all, a chemical used in everything from refrigeration to cosmetics may be partly responsible for the rise in cholesterol levels in this country. PFCs may affect serum cholesterol levels in you. PFCs are highly stable compounds used in commercial and industrial applications such as paper and textile coatings and food packaging. And these compounds have been found to be highly persistent in human tissues, with serum elimination half-lives of more than 8 years for some types of PFCs. Our feature story at coasttocoastam.com, science explaining the wrinkly Sharpei dog. I've always wondered why their skin is always that way. They're kind of cute, aren't they? But scientists have analyzed the genetics of 10 pedigree dog breeds, and they believe they now have the answer to why the Sharpei gets its famous wrinkled appearance. In the Sharpei, the team found differences in a gene known as HAS2, which makes an enzyme known to be important in the production of skin. And in California, they're trying to legalize marijuana. It is on a roll. A bill, legislation to tax and regulate marijuana, has passed part of the assembly. The bill now goes to the full assembly on Friday for consideration. The bill would essentially treat pot the same way as alcohol is treated under the law, and allow adults over 21 to possess, smoke, and grow marijuana. The law also calls for a fee of $50 per ounce sold and would help fund drug eradication and awareness programs, they say. They think this will help pull California out of its debt, raising up to close to $1 billion just from fees alone. And a famed strongman who once lifted 3,200 pounds at Coney Island during its heyday, well, he was still bending quarters with his fingers at the age of 104. He's dead. He got hit by a minivan. Joe Rolino was struck as he crossed a major street in Brooklyn and suffered a broken pelvis, head trauma, and broken ribs. He died a few hours later at an area hospital. And Conan O'Brien has refused to play along with NBC's plan to move The Tonight Show and return Jay Leno to late night, abruptly derailing the network's effort to resolve its scheduling mess, and a mess it is. Nobody knows what's going to happen now. Up next, Joe Garreau joins us. We're going to be talking about radical evolution, the promise and peril of enhancing our minds, our bodies, and what it means to be human. Future genetics and human enhancement next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Let me tell you a little bit about our guest tonight. Joe Garreau is a reporter, editor at The Washington Post, a member of the Global Business Network, and a principal of the Garreau Group, which is a network of his best sources committed to understanding just who we are, how we got this way, and where we're headed. Joel is the author of Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. His book takes a very unprecedented and sometimes alarming look, always spellbinding at the hinge in history at which we have arrived. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Joel, welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Thanks, George.
It's been a while. How have you been?
I'm great.
Super, super, super. Lots going on this planet. You know, this is very fitting for what you've been writing and working on. You know, just that story about people almost committing suicide because of Avatar.
Isn't that weird?
This is strange stuff nowadays. What's happening to us, Joel?
Well, George, we're at a turning point in history. For hundreds of thousands of years, our technologies have been aimed outward at modifying our cities, our agriculture, our, you know, space travel, that sort of thing. But now, increasingly, our technologies are aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, and our kids. And if you can do all that, you're at the astonishing point where we've become the first species to take control of our own evolution. Not in some distant science fiction future, but right now on our watch. And that's what radical evolution is really about. It's the roadmap to the next 5, 10, or 20 years of how we're changing what it means to be human. I mean, someday soon, you're going to run into some kid who's coming home from school again in tears. And he's going to be just complaining that other kids are smarter than he is, more athletic than he is, better behaved, more beautiful, more capable of getting into the best colleges. And the difference is that these other kids' parents will have been embracing all of these technologies that are changing what it means to be human, and you haven't. And the question is, well, what do you do when that day comes? And there's a couple of possibilities. One is you can say to the kid, well, we love you just the way you are. We don't care what other parents do. Just wipe your nose, go play in traffic. You know, or you could say that that maybe what you should do is to remortgage the house again and invest in this arms race and these new technologies so that your kid can keep up with the others. Or you can try to get these enhanced kids thrown out of the school. But the trouble with that last one is that just widens the gap between humans who are increasingly capable, increasingly enhanced, and those who aren't. But what you can't do is ignore this, because these changes in what it means to be human are coming at you right now.
And it's not just with kids, Joel, as you know. I mean, even the adults are bombarded every day with similar things, aren't they?
Sure. The I mean, some of the stuff that's on the market right now is pretty amazing. Stuff like modafinil, which is a prescription pharmaceutical that's widely available. It shuts off the human trigger to sleep. This is not a stimulant. It's not a it's not speed. It doesn't affect your cognition. In fact, when it was tested on healthy young helicopter pilots, they went for 40 hours in a simulator. At the end of the 40 hours flying this simulated helicopter, they were doing as well as or better than the people who were well-rested. And then they let them sleep for 8 hours, and they brought them back up, and they went for another 40 hours. And again, at the end of it, they were doing great. So the question is, well, what happens when you're competing with people who don't have to sleep? You know, imagine lawyers who never sleep.
Or talk show hosts.
There you go. Yeah.
What are you doing these days? What's new with you?
Well, I'm now the professor at Lincoln. Are you ready for this? Your drum roll. Lincoln Professor of Law, Culture, and Values at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University.
When did that happen?
Isn't that amazing? It just happened recently. As you know, I was with the Washington Post for years and years, and now, of course, the Internet is collapsing salary journalism, so I had to look for another thing. And Arizona State is an interesting place. It's got a lot of people who are making the future, who are creating novel life forms, for example, that eat carbon dioxide and poop gasoline.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And they also have people like me who are arm wavers who talk about what this all means to the future of society and culture. But what's unusual at Arizona State is that these makers and these thinkers, they drink with each other. That's really unusual. They really managed to bust the silos between these two groups. Frequently, when you're dealing with scientists who are creating this new future, I remember once talking to researchers who were working on the future of computer-aided telepathy, mind-to-mind communication, and they could quite clearly see how you'd create a helmet that would allow you to do mind-to-mind communication. And I said to them, well, that's all fine, but what happens if you're living in a society full of telepaths? And they looked at me and they said, wow, what an interesting question. I never thought of that
before. They didn't look at that aspect, did they?
You know, and doesn't that make you crazy, that they're building this stuff and they don't ask these questions? Well, that's the nice thing about ASU is that you're this is a place where people are actually asking these questions. And, in fact, I'm involved in a consortium that's thinking about the military implications of this. That's really interesting.
And when you look at the applications for the future, how much of it is related to just military? A lot?
Well, anytime you're looking at any advanced technology, any emerging technology, it's always being adopted first by whoever's in the most competitive kind of situation. So it's not too surprising that when you're talking about human enhancement, the first debates about this emerged on our sports pages of all places, Here we're having this advanced discussion of what it means to be human on the sports pages. Questions like, what does it mean to have these records set by people with steroids? But again, that's just the first, the first rough version of human enhancement. And, what's coming down the pike is so much more mind-blowing. The other area where you see, great competition is with sex appeal. That's why you see early adoption of human enhancement with things like Viagra or Botox. But far and away, the best funded of this is the military. I spent the better part of a year at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is the research and development arm of the military. And there they have been working on human enhancement in ways that really will change our lives.
Let's get into that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Interested in being a StreamLink member for just pennies a day? Just go to coasttocoastam.com. You can sign up for that and get your downloads and your podcasting and your past programs. The archives go back now 3 years. That's going to be expanded again back to 4, then 5 years. And then you also get your iPhone app. If you have an iPhone, you can do some wonderful things with that as well. Back in a moment with our special guest, Joel Garrow, as we talk about radical evolution on Coast to Coast AM. And Joel Garrow is with us. Joel, let's talk about these human enhancements that the military is undertaking. What's out there?
Well, what's interesting when you're looking at the future of human enhancement of radical evolution is that there are four technologies that I call the GRIN technologies, all of which are accelerating at an exponential pace. These are the genetic, robotic, information, and nanotechnologies. An example of one of these was actually at the beginning of this decade. They created the world's first, at DARPA, the military created the world's first telekinetic monkey, a monkey that could move objects long distance with her thoughts. Would you like to know how you make a monkey telekinetic?
I would love to know how you make a monkey telekinetic.
Well, this is at Duke University, and a little owl monkey named Belle, cute little monkey, very smart. And the first thing they did was they got her hooked on computer games. She had a joystick, and she had a screen in front of her. And if she could make the joystick hit a flashing light on the screen, she'd get a drop of juice.
Ah.
But it became real clear, real fast, that she's a smart monkey. She almost cared about the juice at it, right? She got hooked on the computer game. And as soon as that happened, they drilled a hole in her head.
Oh. And that's her reward, right?
That's her reward. And they took an object, took a device about the size of a baby aspirin, out of which was coming hundreds of superfine wires, and they put it in her motor cortex, which is where you plan muscle movements. And the point of these little wires was to line up with individual neurons so that when a neuron fired in the brain, the wire could pick it up and feed it to a computer.
Amazing.
Right? So then they sealed her up and they turned on the computer game again, and she's playing it, and they're watching the patterns on the screen of what's going on in her brain. And as soon as they think they figured out what neurons are associated with what muscle movement, they then do the deed. They disconnect her joystick. So there's nothing that she can do with her arm to control this game, but she pretty soon figures out that all she has to do is think about it, and she can move the cursor and win the game. Then, to be cool about it, they put her brain signal up on the internet and piped it to MIT, 600 miles north, where there was a robotic arm. And just using the signals from her brain, the robotic arm began to dance in exactly the fashion that her arm would have been moving had she been using her arm to play the game.
Jeez.
And now I submit to you that if you've got a monkey who can control a robotic arm 600 miles away with her thoughts, what you've got is a telekinetic monkey. But the obvious question is, why? Why would you want to do this to a monkey? And that's where the military comes in.
Uh-huh.
It turns out that an F-35 jet fighter is an extremely complicated aircraft to fly with a joystick. And the military is thinking, wouldn't it be much better if you could just control this jet with your thoughts? And it would fly where you wanted it to go. And they say, suppose it would be even better if whatever that the airplane was sensing, speed, incoming weapons, whatever, suppose you could pipe that directly into your brain, bypassing keyboards and screens, so that you had a complete mind-machine interface. That's the official reason why they're drilling holes in monkeys' heads. But as usual, there's two reasons. There's the official reason, and then there's the real reason. And in this case, the real reason was that this portion of DARPA that was doing this was run by a guy named Michael Goldblatt. And Michael has a daughter named Gina Marie. Gina Marie is a very talented and successful young lady, graduated from the University of Arizona, and she has cerebral palsy. So she's supposed to spend the rest of her life in a wheelchair. Well, Michael, her father, is way up front about the fact that he spent God only knows how many of your millions of your taxpayers' dollars. Because if you can control machines with your thoughts, in principle, there's no reason why those machines couldn't be in Gina Marie's legs. And so Michael has spent all of this money to get his daughter to get out of that wheelchair and stand up and walk. And that's so there are implications for all of these military technologies about how what's something that's originally designed for the battle space can transform what it means to be human and transform radical evolution.
Joel, remember It's a Good Life in the Twilight Zone. Our friend Billy Mumy, who is a regular guest here on the program, pops in and out, played little Anthony Fremont, the little boy who could just think thoughts, and that's what would happen to you. Mm-hmm. He could turn you into a puppet. He can turn you into he sends you out into the cornfield. He could do whatever he wanted with his brain. What happens if this technology gets so good, this human enhancement, and people just can't control your thoughts? I mean, have you ever been mad enough that you said to yourself, God, I could kill that guy? Now, you know you wouldn't go through with it, but you've thought about it. What would happen under this scenario? Something might, you know, you might blow the guy up.
There's nothing like that on the horizon in the current technology. But what Mattel did bring out this Christmas, the toy company, they brought out the first toy that used mind-machine interface technology. You put on a headset with a little device that rested on your forehead, and it picked up like an electroencephalograph. It picked up the your brain waves, and if you concentrated, it allowed you to levitate a ping pong ball. One of the questions I had is who would want to buy this toy? And I was talking to my daughter about this, and she says, "Oh, this is going to be the biggest thing to hit college since the Frisbee."
Jeez.
because this is going to transform beer pong. But but more seriously, when you look out at the future of these human enhancement technologies, and you ask, I mean, I don't really care about the technologies. I don't care about boys and their toys. I care about culture and values and what this means to our society. And when you ask people, you know, where is this taking us? The answer, you get three scenarios: heaven, hell, and prevail. In the heaven scenario, what happens is these grim technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotechnologies, rapidly accelerate and you conquer pain, suffering, stupidity, ignorance, and even death. And in the next 20, 30, 40 years.
And it all sounds good.
And it all sounds great. That's the heaven scenario. And it's an incredible scenario. It could happen. You pick up the paper, you see amazing advances every day. But that's only one scenario. There's also the mirror opposite, which is the hell scenario, in which, you know, imagine if these technologies end up in the hands of madmen or fools.
Mm, exactly.
And in the hell scenario, it's a credible possibility that you could, you know, imagine wiping out the human race in the next 20 years. And that's the optimistic version. The pessimistic version is the one where you can imagine wiping out of all of life on Earth. But okay, but that, and again, it's a credible scenario, but it's only one. Both heaven and hell are techno-deterministic, meaning that they are both driven by how fast we can get transistors to talk to each other and computers to accelerate, thereby driving genetics and nanotechnology and all the rest. So there's a third scenario, which is prevail, which is the humanistic scenario, and that's the one that I'm pulling for as a humanist. I'm not predicting it, but I am pulling for it. Because prevail is based on the notion that maybe what matters in the future is not how many transistors you can get to talk to each other. Maybe it's how many ornery, cussed, unpredictable, imaginative humans you can get to talk to each other. And the Prevail Project is something that I'm starting at Arizona State University to try to accelerate that third scenario coming into being. Because I'm hoping that, you know, the future is not all about technology. I hope it's about us cussed humans.
That's going to be a battle for you.
Yeah, it is. I don't know if it's possible, to be perfectly honest. But the challenge is, in prevail, is suppose there's not one curve of change. Suppose there's two. If our challenges are coming at us ever faster and ever more accelerating. Well, if our responses are more or less flat, well, obviously we're toast, right? Because the gap just keeps on getting greater between our challenges and our responses. But suppose our responses were going up on a curve that almost matches our challenges. That's at the heart of Prevail. And there's some reasons for guarded optimism that maybe we are pulling this off. When you look at the Middle Ages, for example, at the year 1200, you look out and you see hordes, across the land and all sorts of disease, and you think, okay, this species is toast. But then comes the printing press in 1450, and all of a sudden you got a brand new way of storing and sharing and collecting and distributing ideas. And the results are amazing. I mean, first you get the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment, which leads to science itself and to democracy and the world we've got today. And all of a sudden, all of our worries about the marauding hordes and the plagues seem like ancient history in more ways than one, because our responses are going up. And it's all bottom up. It's not top down. This change was beyond the imagination of any one king or any one country. I mean, the people of Venice didn't wake up one day and decided they were going to invent world trade. They got pushed off their land by the marauding hordes, and they moved out into the swamp, and they started to create a city. And then they noticed that the Pope was going to need a whole lot of ships to move crusaders to Palestine. And that they created their whole new world in a bottom-up way, doing the best they could every day. And that's at the heart of the Prevail scenario. It's about ordinary humans just finding their way in imaginative and unpredictable ways. It happened on 9/11, the fourth airplane, Flight 93, never makes it to its target. Why? Because the Air Force is so smart? No. Because the White House is so smart? Hell no. It's because a couple dozen people on board that aircraft, empowered by their airphone technologies, figure out, diagnose, and cure the society's ills in a little under an hour flat, just as happened on the Christmas Day attempt to do the bombing. The point of this is that this is bottom-up behavior, and the way that you'd guess that perhaps the Prevail scenario was coming to pass is that all of a sudden you might be seeing all sorts of unprecedented flock-like behavior of humans coming up with brand new solutions. And you ask yourself, well, have you seen anything like that lately? Well, how about eBay? That's not just the world's biggest flea market. That's millions of people doing very complicated behavior without leaders. What about YouTube? I mean, that helped affect an election. What about Twitter? I mean, I have no idea what Twitter is good for, but if it flips out the Iranian government, I'm interested.
Well, all right, but with these enhancements,
and
we talked about the positive aspects, and you talked about, if it gets in the hands of the wrong person, why even go in that direction? I mean, what's the need for all of this?
Yeah, there are a bunch of people who are really worried about the hell scenario who really want to see this all stop. And they are frequently referred to as bioconservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making some really excellent points. They're saying, I mean, they're making some gutsy arguments. They think that pain, suffering, and death is actually part of being human, and we should continue to have that as part of the human condition, because if we don't strain ourselves, then what does it mean to be human? And I'm glad they're making arguments like this. They're making arguments about these technologies that I wish that we had been asking questions like this, for example, when we were sold nuclear power back in the 50s.
Or how about when we went into Iraq?
Any of those? When we decided to start putting people into orbit. But the trouble with bioconservatism is that if you say to them, okay, you're right, we really should slow this down. We really should take, you say, okay, so what do we do? How do we do that? And unfortunately, that's where they come up empty, because these technologies just have incredible value to anybody who's an early adopter. And these technologies are not just occurring in the United States. I mean, you're seeing them emerge not just in Britain and Scandinavia and the rest of Europe, but in China, in India, Korea, places like that. And, you know, if you've got technologies that offer, advances to your kids' ability to get into college or your military's ability to move and operate, you know, without sleep and without resupply for weeks, you've got advantages that are hard to overcome. And that's why people are grabbing at these things as fast as they can. I mean, how would you have slowed down the uptake of Viagra, even if you'd wanted it to?
Do you see the day, you know, you're talking about the monkey in what they did with her, I mean, where we literally can communicate with each other by putting these electrodes in our heads, these little ones, and, you know, the ability to just send another message to another electrode in another person?
Yeah.
How you would trigger it, I don't know.
Well, that's called synthetic telepathy. It's mind-to-mind communication via a computer. And that's one of the things that DARPA is throwing big money at, government money. Only this is not invasive. You wouldn't need to have, at least the way they're now trying to create it, that would not require implants. You'd be able to put a helmet on, and you'd end up having what amounts to silent communication between troops, mind-to-mind, perhaps even being able to transmit not only your own thoughts, but being able to transmit into your brain images from distant robots and stuff like that.
How would you know if it was your thoughts or somebody else's? Because little voice in your head would be the same, wouldn't it?
I know.
It would drive me nuts.
I know. You're asking, I mean, so these guys can quite clearly see, all right, so here's what we do. We're going to wire up, you know, we get a readers of your brain waves and the electroencephalograph, and you digitize it, you put it in the helmet, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and so they can see all of the individual points, but then you say, well, what's a society like that like? And they say, wow, what an interesting question. I never thought of that before.
Jeez.
I know. One of the things that we're working at, we've got a consortium that I'm part of at Arizona State University, the Consortium for Emerging Technologies, Military Operations, and National Security. We just sent Mons, and one of the members of this consortium is the Naval Academy, and we're asking questions about the ethics and strategy of a lot of these human enhancement technologies for the military, and there's some pretty good questions being asked. Things like, for example, suppose you enhance these troops, can these enhancements be reversed or not? Well, that's a good question, because if they can't be reversed and you enhance these troops, how do you reintegrate these war fighters back into society when their hitch is up? And if it can be reversed, well, what happens if somebody refuses to be de-enhanced? And what happens if one of these war fighters, what happens if she goes AWOL rather than be de-enhanced? These are the kind of questions that we're asking. Also, what happens if one of our war fighters gets captured? You know, would the prisoner of war conventions obtain, or could the enemy view this guy as technology and decide to take him apart? What makes him tick?
Exactly.
What happens if we capture one of theirs? Now the thing is, these are all questions we don't know the answers yet, but we're working on it. These are questions that I wish we'd asked back in 1944 before we popped the first nuclear weapon. But, you know, back then, too, it was just everybody, all they wanted to do was end the war and make sure this darn bomb worked. And they didn't ask a lot of questions about the significance. So, I mean, I'm giving the military credit for asking some questions that really do look in towards the future of society and not just, you know, run around willy-nilly embracing these things.
Should we even be doing this as a people?
Yeah, that's a great question. Our value, we have our values. The trouble is that even if you accept the bioconservatives' position that maybe we shouldn't be doing this, as a practical matter, how do you stop it?
You can't. That's the problem. Because someone else will always do it.
Because it, you know, this conveys such incredible advantage. these genetic, robotic, and information and nanotechnologies. You know, take stem cells, for example. You know, all of the stuff that we that the government did to try to stop stem cells, it didn't slow it down a bit. It just moved it to Scandinavia and Great Britain.
Joel, we're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and talk with you more about human enhancement and also what you call environmentalism. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.